Good, we're starting the recording now. So this is Tim Entwistle. It's an interview with John Dwyer for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection. John's being interviewed about his association with the society and particularly his interest in weedy plants I'd like to talk to him about today. The interview is taking place on the 1st of March, 2024. It's at John's home, which is at 47 Miller Street in Fitzroy North. And as I said, I'm the interviewer, Tim Entwistle. And John, as I said, please feel free to elaborate on things and I'll bring you back to gardens if we need to. But could I ask you, just as a starting point though, to give me, we always do this, could you give us your full name and where and when you were born?
John Leonard Dwyer. I was born on the 19th of March, 1938. For the first 10 years of my life, we lived at 110A Bulwyn Road, Bulwyn, on the corner of Durang Street. And outside our front door in the nature strip in Durang Street, there was a magnificent plane tree.
And do you remember that
plane tree? I remember that plane tree very well. Yes. It was a pretty small house, though, because by the time we left in 1948, there were five children in the family.
Right. Now, actually, that's a good point to go back a step. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about your family? So your parents and your siblings, just to provide context.
Yeah. Right. Well, my father was a scientist. He had a degree in physics and mathematics. He became a meteorologist and eventually was head of the Bureau of Meteorology. My mother had worked before marriage as a colourist for the photographer Stuart Tompkins. That is, in those days there was not colour photography. There was a sort of beige photography, which would then be coloured by hand for the client. So she used to do that colouring, quite skilled work, really. She was also a very capable needlewoman. She made our clothes, and she later on taught needlework or dressmaking and design at the Stanley College of Dressmaking and Design in the city. Now I'm the oldest of five children. The one after me, Peter, became an engineer, starting on a PMG cadetship, an electrical engineer, although he later did mechanical engineering as well, and became a hospital engineer. His career was as a hospital engineer. Number three was Tony Anthony. He became a spinal surgeon, and since 1981, he's lived in America. Most of that time at Colorado, where he still lives. He lives at Colorado Springs, and his son lives in Denver with children, and his daughter, I think, now lives in Texas. So, but they're a very American family. My sister, Gay, who died last year, was, before marriage, a radiographer. But she gave that up when she got married, I think because of the concerns about exposure to radiation if she were to have children. Her husband was a fireman, interestingly enough. He died before her. She died last September. And my youngest brother, Christopher, who was always a bit of a rebel, partly because he had a difficult childhood. he fell over in the playground at school, and the doctor, the local doctor, didn't set his leg correctly, broke his leg. Leg wasn't set correctly. He had to wear a caliper for most of his boyhood to gradually straighten the leg, which meant that he couldn't take part in most boyhood occupations, although he did like gardening. He was keen on gardening. He now lives... he became an academic teaching political science. Actually, that started in his last year at school. He decided he wanted to do political science. They didn't teach it at the school. That was St Kevin's. They didn't teach it. They were pretty opposed to him doing it, as they weren't teaching it. He did it anyway and got a first-class honour.
Yeah. Now, with all those, and also your parents, there's no clear picture there of gardening or plants. And
my father was a keen gardener.
Was he?
Yes. When we moved, at the end of 1948, we moved to the first house we owned at Box Hill, 52 Watt Street, Box Hill, which had a prize garden. In the front in particular, it had a sunken lawn with elaborate stone edging around the edge of the sunken lawn. It had a variegated hedge with one block red and one block green. Barbarous was the red plant. It had a weeping elm near the front door. It was quite, and it had a camellia over the other side of the garden.
So, John, did he build that garden himself?
No,
or
no, it was like that when we bought it.
Yeah.
In the back, there was an enormous walnut tree, and there was a bed under the walnut tree where he used to plant annuals. So he'd always be, you know, digging up last year's and putting in this year's. I used to get paid threepence an hour to weed the garden. So that was my introduction to gardening. Oh, and mowing the lawns and trimming those hedges. I hated trimming the barberries because of the thorns. But we used to do weeding. There was quite extensive garden to weed in the back in particular. Threepence an hour, so an 8-hour day you'd get 2 shillings.
So that's an introduction to gardening as a way of earning money, I suppose.
Yes.
Do you remember it fondly in terms of the garden itself?
Not really.
Yeah.
No, my real interest in gardening came much later.
Let's hold. We'll come to that too. Yeah. Tell me. Yeah, continue on that if you like about that garden. Yeah.
It had some fruit trees at the back, including a quince tree that I was very fond of. I used to like climbing up the quince tree with a book, and sitting there eating a quince while reading the book.
The practical aspects of the garden. I'm going to come back to your interest in gardens, but I'd like to first start with your early life, particularly at university and moving into law, just as a background before we get to the garden.
All right. Well, my primary education was with the St Joseph Nuns, first of all in Bourne at a little school. That was a church on Sundays and had a partition to divide it in half. And there were, prep 1, 2, 3 on one side and perhaps it was 3, 4, 5 on the other side. I got promoted there from the class that I was in. I got pushed up a grade. That had the result that throughout my schooling, I was always the youngest in the class. They only went up to grade 5. I then did grades 6 and 7 also with the nuns at Surrey Hills, tram up from Balwyn in 1948, bus down from Box Hill in 1949. Then I got a scholarship to a school called St Coleman's in Young Street, Fitzroy, where that was run by a very fierce Christian brother called Brother Bowler, who was a very liberal user of the strap.
Mm.
The day would commence with lessons, and say you'd start with Latin, you'd have Latin lessons, and then it would be one mistake, one cut, two mistakes, two cuts, three mistakes, three cuts, four or more mistakes, four cuts. You would have to line up against the wall of the classroom in the appropriate spot for the number of cuts you were going to get. Then you would come along and give everybody their cuts.
This begs the question, John. Were you good at Latin, and did that process help you one way or the other?
No.
Right.
Indeed, it somehow never made me think that it would be a good idea to prepare the lessons the night before. I always did them on the tram on the way to school.
So it didn't really affect
it. It was not effective, but it was there. And it was not uncommon for me to have had 20 cuts by the morning break. But anyway, I got a scholarship.
Mm.
Most of the people in the class did. The curriculum even included intelligence tests, because that was one of the things that you had to do for what was called a junior government scholarship. So we had a lot of practice in doing intelligence tests, thereby, of course, rather avoiding the point of the intelligence test. Anyway, I got a junior government scholarship, and I went to St Kevin's with that. I finished up doing 2 years in year 12 because I was so young. I was I was only 16 in my first year 12, so my father thought I should do a second year 12. He was also very keen for me to do well scholastically. I'd done quite well in the public exams at the end of my first year 12. I'd got a couple of firsts.
Mm.
But he wanted me to do better than that.
Yeah.
So, but then they made me school captain. And I remember when the headmaster took me to his study to tell me that I was going to be school captain, I said, I don't know that my father will like that. He wants me to do very well academically. So we rang my father at work to get his approval for the school to make me school captain. I've always thought it's a wonder they didn't say, well, perhaps we'll get somebody else.
Yes, you're too hesitant.
Yeah. Anyway, but I was school captain, and I did get the Latin prize, but that was the best of a bad lot, and I was dux of the school. Australian history, which I did in the first year, was one of my strengths. I got a prize for that in both of those years, although it wasn't on the curriculum in the second year. Then it was British history. Anyway, then I started law.
And just if I can ask, when you moved into law, was that because you were doing so successful and had ducks and it was expected, or did you have an interest in it?
No, it was because my father thought it was a natural thing to do.
I can see a trend here.
Well, I was good at humanities subjects, although he said I should do calculus and applied maths in my first year matric, and I would have done pure maths in my second, except that it was on at the same time as Latin, so we thought Latin was more important if I was going to do law, so I did general maths instead of pure maths. General maths was a bit of a wonk, really. Statistics and that sort of thing. But people said, you'll never pass calculus and applied maths, doing it by itself with all these other subjects. But I did quite a solid pass. I didn't get an honour, but I got a solid pass.
Mm.
Even though comparing notes with my classmates after the exam, I hadn't got one question right. But
I might talk to you about that afterwards, John, because they do that in maths.
Yeah, I got it for method.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a good pass for method.
Now, I better keep you moving so we get to go.
Okay. But we get to law.
Get into law, yeah.
Yes, all right. Well, I worked hard at British history and law in first year. British history law it was. And I got a first in that, I got a third in introduction to legal method. I got in my second year, I did another history subject, modern history, where my tutor was Inga Clendinnen. She was a very good tutor, but I only got a third in that, and I just passes in the other subjects. And then I was in a thing called the Newman Society, and the chaplain was a Jesuit called Father Golden. And he decided at the end of second year that I should go into residence at Newman. I'd won a non-resident scholarship, but he said he thought I should go into residence. And I said, I can't afford it. I haven't got the money. And he said, I'll get some money for you. So he got a large contribution towards the fees, and they converted my non-resident scholarship into a resident scholarship. So I was then in Newman for 2 years.
That's the first time you moved out of home?
Yes.
And did you enjoy that?
Not especially. No. Newman was a fair experience, I think. I co-edited the college magazine in my second year, but my study habits in those days, such as they were to work late into the night and get up late in the morning. So I rarely made it to breakfast. My mother used to make me a fruitcake each weekend, and for breakfast I'd have a slice of her fruitcake and a coffee in my room. I did room with, in first year was just some boy from the bush who I had nothing in common with. The only thing was, when it came to final study for exams, I would be going to bed just before dawn. You had to go to bed before dawn because of all the birds in the garden at Newman. And he would be getting up, being a country boy. That was about all we had in common.
Well, and I'm also pleased the garden started to make its way into your life.
Yes. And so, anyway, I had only modest results, and I was a subject or two short of the degree at the end of my final year. I had seen a solicitor called T.W. Brennan, who was the first Dux of St. Kevin's, actually. But had been a Labour politician, but with the split, had gone with the DLP, so he was no longer in the. He had been in the MLC. Mm. He was no longer in Parliament. He said he'd take me as an article clerk, and he was prepared to do that, even though I still had in the first year to do a couple of subjects to finish my degree. So I then stayed with him for 2 years, and then the thing that I've left out chronologically is that I joined the Melbourne University Regiment. I did that in 1957, so just before my second year, and I did that because I failed national service because of my eyesight. I didn't pass the medical, and I took that as an affront to my manhood. So, and my father had been in the Melbourne University Regiment, so I joined the Melbourne University Regiment as a volunteer, and I did that. I was in the Melbourne University Regiment and then another unit until 1969. So I had a good solid burst with the army, and that's where I started.
Good, we're starting the recording now. So this is Tim Entwistle. It's an interview with John Dwyer for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection. John's being interviewed about his association with the society and particularly his interest in weedy plants I'd like to talk to him about today. The interview is taking place on the 1st of March 2024. It's at John's home, which is at 47 Miller Street in Fitzroy North. And as I said, I'm the interviewer, Tim Entwistle. And John, as I said, please feel free to elaborate on things and I'll bring you back to gardens if we need to. But could I ask you, just as a starting point though, to give me, we always do this, could you give us your full name and where and when you were born?
John Leonard Dwyer. I was born on the 19th of March 1938. For the first 10 years of my life, we lived at 110A Bulwyn Road, Bulwyn, on the corner of Durang Street. And outside our front door in the nature strip in Durang Street, there was a magnificent plane tree.
And do you remember that plane
tree? I remember that plane tree very well. Yes. It was a pretty small house, though, because by the time we left in 1948, there were five children in the family.
Right. Now, actually, that's a good point to go back a step. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about your family? So your parents and your siblings, just to provide context.
Yeah. Right. Well, my father is was a scientist. He had a degree in physics and mathematics. He became a meteorologist and eventually was head of the Bureau of Meteorology. My mother had worked before marriage as a colourist for the photographer Stuart Tompkins. That is, in those days there was not colour photography. There was sort of beige photography, which would then be coloured by hand for the client. So she used to do that colouring, quite skilled work, really. She was also a very capable needlewoman. She made our clothes, and she later on taught needlework or dressmaking and design at the Stanley College of Dressmaking and Design in the city. Now I'm the oldest of five children. The one after me, Peter, became an engineer, starting on a PMG cadetship, an electrical engineer, mm-hmm. although he later did mechanical engineering as well, and became a hospital engineer. His career was as a hospital engineer. Number three was Tony Anthony. He became a spinal surgeon, and since 1981, he's lived in America. Most of that time at Colorado, where he still lives. He lives at Colorado Springs, and his son lives in Denver with children, and his daughter, I think, now lives in Texas. So, but they're a very American family. My sister, Gay, who died last year, was, before marriage, a radiographer. But she gave that up when she got married, I think because of the concerns about exposure to radiation if she were to have children. Her husband was a fireman, interestingly enough. He died before her. She died last September. And my youngest brother, Christopher, who was always a bit of a rebel, partly because he had a difficult childhood, he fell over in the playground at school, and the doctor, the local doctor, didn't set his leg correctly. He broke his leg. Leg wasn't set correctly. He had to wear a caliper for most of his boyhood to gradually straighten the leg, which meant that he couldn't take part in most boyhood occupations, although he did like gardening. He was keen on gardening. He now lives... He became an academic teaching political science. Actually, that started in his last year at school. He decided he wanted to do political science. They didn't teach it at the school. That was St Kevin's. They didn't teach it. They were pretty opposed to him doing it, as they weren't teaching it. He did it anyway and got a first-class honour.
Yeah. Now, with all those, and also your parents, there's no clear picture there of gardening or plants. And
my father was a keen gardener.
Was he?
Yes. When we moved, at the end of 1948, we moved to the first house we owned at Box Hill, 52 Watt Street, Box Hill, which had a prize garden. In the front in particular, it had a sunken lawn with elaborate stone edging round the edge of the sunken lawn. It had a variegated hedge with one block red and one block green. Barbarous was the red plant. It had a weeping elm near the front door. It had a camellia over the other side of the garden.
So, John, did he build that garden himself?
No,
or
no, it was like that when we bought it.
Yeah.
In the back, there was an enormous walnut tree, and there was a bed under the walnut tree where he used to plant annuals. He'd always be, you know, digging up last year's and putting in this year's. I used to get paid threepence an hour to weed the garden. So that was my introduction to gardening. Oh, and mowing the lawns and trimming those hedges. I hated trimming the barberries because of the thorns. But we used to do weeding. There was quite extensive garden to weed in the back in particular. Threepence an hour, so an 8-hour day you'd get 2 shillings.
So that's the introduction to gardening as a way of earning money, I suppose.
Yes.
Do you remember it fondly in terms of the garden itself?
Not really.
Yeah.
My real interest in gardening came much later.
Let's hold. We'll come to that too. Yeah. Continue on that if you like about that garden. Yeah.
It had some fruit trees at the back, including a quince tree that I was very fond of. I used to like climbing up the quince tree with a book and sitting there eating a quince while reading the book.
The practical aspects of the garden. I'm going to come back to your interest in gardens, but I'd like to first start with your early life, particularly at university and moving into law, just as a background before we get to the garden.
All right. Well, my secondary education, my primary education was with the St Joseph Nuns, first of all in Bourne at a little school. That was a church on Sundays and had a partition to divide it in half. And there were, prep 1, 2, 3 on one side and perhaps it was 3, 4, 5 on the other side. I got promoted there from the class that I was in. I got pushed up a grade. That had the result that throughout my schooling, I was always the youngest in the class. They only went up to grade 5. I then did grades 6 and 7 also with the nuns at Surrey Hills, tram up from Bulwyn in 1948, bus down from Box Hill in 1949. Then I got a scholarship to a school called St Colman's in Young Street, Fitzroy, where that was run by a very fierce Christian brother called Brother Bowler, who was a very liberal user of the strap.
Mm.
The day would commence with lessons, and say you'd start with Latin, you'd have Latin lessons, and then it would be one mistake, one cut, two mistakes, two cuts, three mistakes, three cuts, four or more mistakes, four cuts. You would have to line up against the wall of the classroom in the appropriate spot for the number of cuts you were going to get. Then you would come along and give everybody their cuts.
This begs the question, John. Were you good at Latin, and did that process help you one way or the other?
No, no.
Right.
Indeed, it somehow never made me think that it would be a good idea to prepare the lessons the night before. I always did them on the tram on the way to school.
So it didn't really affect
it. It was not effective, but it was there. And it was not uncommon for me to have had 20 cuts by the morning break. But anyway, I got a scholarship.
Mm.
Most of the people in the class did. The curriculum even included intelligence tests, because that was one of the things that you had to do for what was called a junior government scholarship. So we had a lot of practice in doing intelligence tests, thereby, of course, rather voiding the point of the intelligence test. Anyway, I got a junior government scholarship, and I went to St Kevin's with that. I finished up doing 2 years in year 12 because I was so young. I was I was only 16 in my first year 12, so my father thought I should do a second year 12. He was also very keen for me to do well scholastically. I'd done quite well in the public exams at the end of my first year 12. I'd got a couple of firsts, but he wanted me to do better than that.
Yeah.
So, but then they made me school captain. And I remember when the headmaster took me to his study to tell me that I was going to be school captain, I said, oh, I don't know that my father will like that. He wants me to do very well academically. So we rang my father at work to get his approval for the school to make me school captain. I've always thought it's a wonder they didn't say, well, perhaps we'll get somebody else.
Yes, you're too hesitant.
Yeah. Anyway, but I was school captain. And I did get the Latin prize, but that was the best of a bad lot. And I was ducks of the school. Australian history, which I did in the first year, was one of my strengths. I got a prize for that in both of those years, although it wasn't on the curriculum in the second year. Then it was British history. Anyway, then I started law.
And just if I can ask, when you moved into law, was that because you were doing so successful and had ducks and it was expected, or did you have an interest in it?
No, it was because my father thought it was a natural thing to do.
I can see a trend here.
Well, I was good at humanities subjects, although he said I should do calculus and applied maths in my first year matric, and I would have done pure maths in my second, except that it was on at the same time as Latin, so we thought Latin was more important if I was going to do law, so I did general maths instead of pure maths. General maths was a bit of a wonk, really, statistics and that sort of thing. But people said, oh, you'll never pass calculus and applied maths doing it by itself with all these other subjects. But I did quite a solid pass. I didn't get an honour, but I got a solid pass.
Mm.
Even though comparing notes with my classmates after the exam, I hadn't got one question right. But
I might talk to you about that afterwards, John, because they do that in maths.
Yeah, I got it for method.
Yeah.
Yeah, a good pass for method.
Now, I better keep you moving so we get to go.
Okay, but we get to law.
Get into law, yeah.
Yes, all right. Well, I worked hard at British history and law in first year. British history law it was. And I got a first in that, I got a third in introduction to legal method. I got in my second year, I did another history subject, modern history, where my tutor was Inga Clendinnen. She was a very good tutor, but I only got a third in that, and I just passes in the other subjects. And then I was in a thing called the Newman Society, and the chaplain was a Jesuit called Father Golden. And he decided at the end of second year that I should go into residence at Newman. I'd won a non-resident scholarship, but he said he thought I should go into residence. And I said, I can't afford it. I haven't got the money. And he said, oh, I'll get some money for you. So he got a large contribution towards the fees, and they converted my non-resident scholarship into a resident scholarship. So I was then in Newman for 2 years.
That's the first time you moved out of home?
Yes.
And did you enjoy that?
Not especially. No. Newman was a fair experience, I think. I co-edited the college magazine in my second year. But my study habits in those days, such as they were to work late into the night and get up late in the morning. So I rarely made it to breakfast. My mother used to make me a fruitcake each weekend, and for breakfast I'd have a slice of her fruitcake and a coffee in my room. I did room with, in first year was just some boy from the bush who I had nothing in common with. The only thing was, when it came to final study for exams, I would be going to bed just before dawn. You had to go to bed before dawn because of all the birds in the garden at Newman. And he would be getting up, being a country boy. That was about all we had in common.
Well, and I'm also pleased the garden started to make its way into your life.
Yes. And so, anyway, I had only modest results, and I was a subject or two short of the degree at the end of my final year. But I had seen a solicitor called T.W. Brennan, who was the first Dux of St. Kevin's, actually, but who had been a Labour politician, but with the split had gone with the DLP, so he was no longer he had been in MLC, he was no longer in Parliament. He said he'd take me as an article clerk, and he was prepared to do that even though I still had in the first year to do a couple of subjects to finish my degree. So I then stayed with him for 2 years, and then the thing that I've left out chronologically is that I joined the Melbourne University Regiment. I did that in 1957, so just before my second year, and I did that because I failed national service because of my eyesight. I didn't pass the medical, and I took that as an affront to my manhood. So, and my father had been in the Melbourne University Regiment, so I joined the Melbourne University Regiment as a volunteer, and I did that. I was in the Melbourne University Regiment and then another unit until 1969. So I had a good solid burst with the army, and that's where I started going on hikes and camping and things like that. So that was really the army was really my introduction to the Australian bush.
Oh, good. Okay.
We're at the stage we 19. I got admitted in 1962. There was a man called David Bullard in the same building, just next door to where our office was in the city. He was doing the managing clerks course, which was where you did all your subjects part time. And you, as a managing clerk, you then got admitted. He was two subjects short when his principal died, and so I moved into his office as the solicitor while he finished his two subjects and got qualified. And he then employed me as a solicitor because it was really his practice. So then I signed the bar roll in December 1963. Joni was overseas at this stage. She did a year's trip.
So you'd not met her, or you have met Joan by then?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yes. We were quite an item before she went overseas.
So let's maybe just pause on the education for a moment to put Joan into the story.
Yes.
Well,
I met her at the university.
Okay.
She was also doing law. She was introduced to me by a lady called Judy Hogg, who was a very old family friend who was also doing law in the same year as Joan. We became very close before she went on this trip. I think she went on the trip to test how serious we were. I've got a box full of our correspondence.
So you passed?
Yes, I passed the test, and we got engaged in 1964 when she came back from the trip.
Was this the trip, just to recall something you said before we started taping, was this the one where you sent flowers, or was that later?
Yes, it was.
It's worth recalling that.
Yes. But the other thing that's worth recording is that she had worked as a research assistant for Zelman Cowan for a year after she finished a degree. She had a letter of introduction from Zelman Cowan to a Jewish solicitor in London. She went and saw him and asked whether he'd give her a job. He said, "Oh no, I think my clients wouldn't be able to understand your Australian accent." She then remembered that there was a man called Kevin Kennedy, an Irishman, who was a partner in a firm called Farrar's that her parents had met in Paris, I think, and became quite friendly with. And so she thought, "Well, I'll go and try him." She went and tried him, and he said, "Yes, we'll give you a job as a law clerk. Farrar's are solicitors, or were solicitors to the Queen." So
she started at the top.
She was doing quite well.
And I should have added, just when you mentioned flowers, the story there was that you sent flowers to every port as before she would arrive. She would come to
them. They'd be waiting for
her. Do you know what flowers you sent, or at that time it would have been?
Whatever the florist could. They were local, of course.
Of course.
So whatever the florist could tell me would be there. And there were so many that she had to share them around the dining room.
I like that. Let's return back to your it's up to you to get into law. Description of your time in law, so we can get onto the gardening side, but perhaps also your time with Joan and your family as well.
Yeah. Well, in those days it wasn't so hard to get into law. Indeed, it wasn't so hard to get a Commonwealth scholarship, which everyone relied on. I know there was one person I knew who had whose matriculation result had been three subjects and a compensatory pass, and still got a Commonwealth scholarship. So I had a Commonwealth scholarship for that. There may have been fees to pay while I was doing the article subjects, because you had, after your law degree, you had to do article subjects. Accounts was one of them. Professional conduct was the other one. And you may have had to pay fees for those.
Mm.
And perhaps I had to pay fees for the philosophy subjects that I was doing. I started doing philosophy subjects because I was friendly with a number of philosophers at the university. I really got interested in talks with them.
This is after you finished your law degree?
No, during it.
During, yeah.
During it.
Okay.
Through the Newman Society.
Mm-hmm.
I had had a go at Latin 1 and failed it earlier on. And that was the one subject left to get my arts degree. And I thought, why do I waste my time doing Latin 1? I could do an MA qualifying year. So I did an MA qualifying year using my law degree. You could do an MA qualifying year. You did a number of subjects. And I encountered some very good teaching. But that was part-time while I was working in the solicitor's offices.
Okay.
And then I started on a PhD. And I had a few supervisors, but in the end, the supervisor was a man I knew, Tony Cody, who was a philosopher who'd come down from Sydney and finished his MA in Melbourne. Melbourne had a very high standing in philosophy in those days. So he was my supervisor. When it came to submit it, I told him that I wouldn't submit it unless he thought I'd get a first. But I duly got a first. I had to do a viva before I got the first, but I succeeded in the viva.
Can I ask the topic and the description of what the PhD was on?
It's on describing acts. It's lots of people said that there could be many different descriptions of the same act from different points of view. I modelled it all on a High Court case where a young man had shot a girl who was trespassing on the family property, and his argument was that it was a mistake, he hadn't meant to kill her. So there was a question of what was his act. And I looked at what a lot of philosophers had said about acts, and I argued that what was really the act was what a person was intending to do, what they were about. The other things may have just been incidentals, but they couldn't stand as a description of the act. So that's...
This is the distinction between consequences and intent. Is that what that be? Is that the difference or not?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Or the physical acts and intent, you know.
Yeah.
People were suggesting things like he held the gun, he pulled the trigger on the gun, he shot the girl, could all stand as descriptions of his act. I argued no, unless that was what he was about.
Well, now I'm going to take you a quick diversion here. I shouldn't do this, but this, I understand, is also a key point for where someone who became quite a famous philosopher and related to you by marriage, Peter Singer.
Yes.
And it was around that, a discussion around that issue, perhaps. I think I understand he would have a slightly different perspective on that.
He is a consequentialist.
Yes.
But I had before I did my viva, I had a meeting with him in the CAF, and we talked philosophy just to get my mind tuned up before I went and did the viva. But although he's a consequentialist, he's pretty broad-minded. So he didn't.
And And I should probably, at that point he was already studying philosophy, but I understand you had a role in him becoming interested in philosophy.
Yes, yes. That was back when he was still at school.
Hmm.
So he then did a combined history and philosophy for his art subjects. He did a couple of law subjects and then let that go. And then he actually wanted to do his MA in history. But he wanted to do it on the Holocaust, and the department wouldn't let him do that, I think because they wanted students for an MA in history to work from original sources, and he couldn't do that in Melbourne. So he then said, all right, I'll do it in philosophy. Mm. So... And his MA thesis was, Why Should I Be Moral? In which he looked at a large number of moral philosophers, and some he gave a pass to, some he gave a cross to, and so on.
And you played a role, first of all, in him becoming interested in philosophy.
Yes, yeah. He only became... a vegetarian at Oxford, and that was due to a fellow student. While he was doing his BPhil at Oxford, there was a fellow student who was a very keen vegetarian on the ground that it was wrong to kill animals. Peter was converted, and the first book he wrote was on civil disobedience. But the book that made, the next one that made him famous was Animal Liberation.
Mm.
I've got a shelf full of the books that he's written since then. He keeps on writing books.
He does.
Things like, I think he wrote a book about George Bush as the president of good and evil. He wrote a book, Why Should I Be Moral? Should the Baby Live is another controversial book that he did.
Yeah, it's my fault. We'll have a whole interview about Peter Singer, which is not appropriate, but perhaps if I drop back to your influences on him, and you would have different, as you've already mentioned, slightly different views. So do you still discuss things with him, or would you, I suppose more interesting to this interview is... has he tested or questioned your own approach to life at times, or have you done the same to him?
Not really. No. He's become quite a keen gardener, I should say.
Oh, so you have had an influence. That's positive.
But I think that's because their father was a keen gardener,
right.
Joan and Peter's father. And Joan was a keen gardener when we married.
So we're sorry. We probably should point out that Joan's sister married... Peter, is that right?
No. Peter is Joan's brother.
Peter's Joan's brother. Sorry,
that's right. They had two children.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get back.
I should say that Peter's written a book about his Viennese grandparents. His father, his grandfather on his mother's side, David Oppenheim, was a colleague of Freud's in the Wednesday Circle.
Wow.
His grandmother, the wife of his grandfather, was a PhD in mathematics from the University of Vienna. Now, this is 19th century PhD in Vienna, so they're pretty amazing forebears.
Now, I'm going to have to get you back to John Dwyer.
Okay.
Now, we might move quickly through. We can sort of come back to it too, but you ended up working through law...
Yes.
Becoming a barrister eventually.
Yes.
And that, I don't know if you can kind of sum up that trajectory.
Yes. And then when Joan thought I shouldn't go to Oxford, Peter, who was at Oxford, started cutting out classified ads from the Times and posting them to me for legal jobs in England. And eventually I got a job at Durham for a year. And we all went to Durham, where, excuse me,
Durham being a very beautiful city with a lovely beautiful cathedral.
Oh. Yeah. We found a house sort of on the outskirts of Durham, or a flat, I should say, in an old house that later became the Vice Chancellor's residence. Beautiful grounds. What was I going to say about Durham? Yes, well, the first thing is that Janie was pregnant with Tessa when we already had Bridget.
So I probably, one thing we didn't point out, so you got married?
Yes.
And that was just the year for that, do you remember?
Yes, 1965, January 1965.
Yep.
Honeymoon in Tasmania.
Yep.
Where we explored things like Lake St Clair and other scenic spots. We hired a car and did a bit of touring around Tasmania. Bridget was born in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
That was why I stopped going to camp with the army, because I went to camp for a couple of weeks in January 1969, and then I saw that Joni had to struggle a bit while I was gone, so I thought that wasn't fair, and the family was much higher priority than the army, which I was only moderately interested in anyway, although I was a captain by then. And then she was pregnant with Tess when we arrived in Durham, so Tess was born in Durham. She did do, the professor did find a little tutoring for her Tess was born in December. In the following year, he found in the third term, a little tutoring for Joan in family law to keep her hand in, as he said. But I taught a wide range of subjects at Durham. I enjoyed it.
Mm.
And then at the end of my year, they invited me to apply for a position there. But I decided against that for two reasons, actually. One, I thought it unfair to Joan's parents as refugees to prolong our stay in England. And second, because I missed the cut and thrust of the bar. I found academic work was quite good, but the bar was much more exciting, really. And at the end of the time in Durham, Louis Waller, who was then Dean of Monash, came up and visited us. We knew Louis from Melbourne. Joan did in particular. She'd worked with him at Melbourne. He came up and visited us and invited me to apply as a fractional lecturer at Monash. They were looking to have people with practical experience as well as legal knowledge. And I think my first class honours philosophy degree was useful there. So they paid half our fare back to Australia when we came, but we didn't. We toured a bit on our way back. We didn't come directly back at the end of the English academic year. We came through Europe, and I know we stopped over at Hong Kong as one of the places on the way back. We stopped at Venice on the way back. Then I was combining Monash and the bar. I had a run-in with the professor. Louis Waller had stopped being dean of the department. A man called David Allen became dean. He wanted me to do some job, which I asked whether I could do it during the law vacation. He took exception to this. He thought I should be more available at Monash. And so at very short notice, a couple of hours notice, he required that I attend at Monash for a meeting to sort out how often I was going to be there. And I said, well, can I bring somebody to support me? And he said, yes. and he said, I'll have Professor Gerard Nash there then as well. And I got a solicitor, as he then was, Peter Barmford, who had done some work for Joan's father. That's really how we knew him. And he came out with me and, to Monash. He handled David Allen superbly. He had him eating out of his hand. Yes.
We'll stop while your clock goes, because that's okay. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Dean. Of course, Mr. Dean. Absolutely, Mr. Dean. And a compromise was arrived at, was that in addition to the lectures I was giving three mornings a week, I was giving a lecture at 9 o'clock. So that I could be in court at 10:30. I would be in attendance at Monash for two afternoons a week. So without specifying what the afternoons would be, that would depend on whether I was in court or not.
Okay.
So that was a pretty good solution.
Yeah.
And then in... Then I... one of my early cases was a case about consumer credit, and I got invited then to go on, although I lost the case, the judge said nice things about me. I got invited to go on a Law Institute committee that was looking into reform of the law of consumer credit. And through that, I met an English lawyer called Patrick Attia, who was then at ANU. But very soon after I'd met him, he went back to England and had a job at Warwick. And so when I had a six-month sabbatical that I could take in 1975, so we went to Warwick so that I could work with him. The girls went to the local school in we were at the edge of Warwick called Coton End, which was sort of on the Leamington side of Warwick.
Mm.
The girls went to just the local school where they had grass, but you weren't allowed to walk on it. They coped quite well. Indeed, they had previously been doing their primary schooling at Presshill, the modern school, where Tess did well, but Bridget, it didn't suit Bridget, so she learned a lot more at the school in England than she had at Presshill. Anyway, the 6 months at Warwick went very well. What I've left out of the chronology is that we had joined the National Trust in that 70-71 year, and we had started visiting National Trust properties and gardens. And then we took out, when we came back to Melbourne...
Sorry, you joined the National Trust in...
In England.
In England, yeah.
Then when we came back to Melbourne,
yeah.
We joined the National Trust here in 73. So in 75, as a member of the Victorian National Trust, you got access to trust properties. We had a good 6 months in 75. Then, for the academic year 70, we came back then and I resumed life as it had been. Then, for the academic year 76-77, Patrick Attia was writing a book, and he got a special grant that said that his teaching had to be replaced, and so they appointed me a visiting reader at Warwick for that year, 76-77, and that was, it was very interesting. I certainly helped him with his book.
So is that, sorry, you returned to Warwick, or is that...
That's right, yeah, we returned to Warwick, yeah. To the same house that we'd lived in Warwick the first time. Luckily, it fell vacant, so we had a year back in that house.
Yeah.
I certainly helped Patrick with his book, because as he wrote a chapter, he'd give it to me and I'd read the chapter and we'd then discuss it.
Mm.
And he'd then turn it into a final draft.
Okay.
But we started to explore England a lot more in that year, because we bought a camper van, and we would go to places like the Lake District in the camper van. We went even as far as the Isle of Skye in the camper van. Had to get a ferry across, of course, mm. but so we started, and Wales we went to in the camper van. You know, we really started exploring England and its landscape and became very fond of it. At the stairs here, we've got a poster which is English landscape with just the word England written at the bottom of it, and it's a country scene.
That landscape for you, is that the built landscape, the natural landscape, or you know, the commons, the natural landscape?
Well, the cultivated landscape.
Cultivated, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, which is something we'll get to, which I better get to, because I'm now so...
Okay, all right. So that's got us to there. When we came back through Europe with the camper van... I've left out one little adventure in 1975. We bought a car there from a second-hand car, Vauxhall Victor, that had been done up by our landlord and served us pretty well. But then at the end of our time, we had some friends from Durham. He was a mathematician. They'd been poor as church mice in Durham, so much so that their family car was a van, a little Morris mini van with no windows in the back. And their daughter, who was in play school with Bridget, you had to ride in that. So we wrote to them. By this time, in 75, he'd got a job at CERN. And we wrote to them. They were living in France, just over the border from CERN, and said we'd like to come and see them, and we'd like to give them this car. We told them what it was.
Mm.
And they wrote back and said, "Oh, great. We're looking forward to seeing you. Do come." But when we got there, we found that they'd gone up in the world, rather. The position in CERN was well paid. They didn't want our car. So we then drove it across Europe till we got to Venice. Here we are with this second-hand car in Venice. We'd already booked a ferry ride down the Adriatic to Greece. So we thought, well, I'd better do something to get rid of this car in Venice. So what I did in the end, after we'd unloaded all our stuff and put it in the accommodation we had, I went to the railway station in Venice looking for someone to give it to.
Mm.
And I approached an English couple and said, you know, would you like, I've got a car in the car park, would you like me to give it to you? And the lady turned up and said, oh, no, thank you. But there was an American coloured soldier there with his girlfriend. So I approached him and he said, "No, I'll come and have a look at it." So I gave it to him.
Lovely.
With I had the papers in it,
mm.
so I signed it over to them.
I love that. But as I said, look, I better move through.
Yes, we're a bit off gardening, aren't we?
We are. We've got to get back to gardening. So maybe yeah. If we take you through... You worked in law for 50 years, is that right? You continued to sort of travel...
40 years.
40 years, and you travelled during that time quite a lot.
Virtually every year.
Yeah.
Partly because Joan's mother was a doctor, a graduate of the University of Vienna. In the 1980s, when I developed rheumatoid arthritis... A doctor friend visited from Austria, and he said to her at some stage, Cora, I can't understand why you don't send John to Awanotemi. So we investigated and I started going to Awanotemi, which is near Padua in the Eugenian Hills.
Mm-hmm.
You fly into Venice. You, of course, spend a bit of time in Venice. Then you could get a taxi even down to Awanotemi. I did at least 12 or 13 annual visits to Awanotemi, which we would always add something else onto. And even the treatment itself was all done before breakfast. So you had the whole... I had to recover a bit during the day,
mm.
but we had the afternoons to visit local places and things.
Mm.
But apart from that, we used to go to Australian Bar conferences overseas, Greek-Australian medico-legal conferences in Greece, and just general sightseeing. I mean, in 2002, for example, we did a trek in Nepal. We did half the... you flew up to the top,
mm.
the high point, you stayed overnight, and then you walked back. And that was half a trek. It took about 5 or 6 days. I did that. Jan persuaded me to do that because we timed it so that the rhododendrons would be in flower.
Well, this is a good point then This is a few years after, I think, you began a part-time certificate course in horticulture at Burnley, which was that 1999? I think.
Yes. I'm sorry, that is 1999. What had happened, we had acquired the property at Callista in 1993, which is on 2 acres with a magnificent garden. A lot of it an old garden, old trees,
mm-hmm.
and old camellias. But on the view side, it looks out over the Yarra Valley, and on the view side, Jeremy Francis had put in two terraces with camellias in them. With rhododendrons in them and similar plants. So we bought that in 1993, and we'd worked hard in the garden with some help, but I decided I'd better learn to be a better gardener. Until then, with the gardens we'd had in our houses where we lived, Joni had been the gardener and I had worked under her supervision. She'd get me to do the jobs that were too hard for her and things. And I suppose she taught me a bit too about it all. But I decided I'd better learn how to be a good gardener. So at the beginning of 99, I enrolled in the Certificate of Horticulture at Burnley, part-time, and then I compared my enjoyment of life at Burnley with my enjoyment of life at the bar.
Just before you make that decision,
yes.
Can I just ask, it does seem like a bit of a career shift, probably not unusual these days, it's very typical, probably people often go to horticulture later in life. I'm wondering for you, even though you were enthusiastic, you enjoyed the garden, to actually learn about it. What would you say precipitated that? Is it, well, maybe it leads to that next question.
Well, they did run a night course over several nights earlier on, which was just introduction to horticulture.
Hmm.
So I'd done that, and that sort of made me think I wanted to learn
more. A spark was.
Yes, that really did the spark, yes.
And actually, one thing we didn't mention right back at the start, this is a terrible time to raise it, but I think I saw you mentioned somewhere in your book, I think your recent book, around your grandfather used to get the Wildlife magazine and Crosby Morrison,
yes.
And so I'm just wondering if there seems to be this latent interest sort of...
Well, it was a latent interest, yes. But I mean, I liked the magazine, but I didn't form a passion at that stage.
That was probably as a young person just curious,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
that's right.
So now, sorry to interrupt you. So we come back and you you're doing this course, yeah. You're looking at your life, your yes. law, and you're making a decision.
Yes, we'd been looking around a bit for a weekender, and we found it because we'd gone up to the Dandenongs to look at an Edna Walling garden that was actually for the house and garden was for sale, by auction, but we looked at it and it didn't suit us at all. Then we went to buy some plants, and we went to Cloud Hill, and as Joan was paying for the plants, they had a pile of brochures on the desk at Cloud Hill, and she brought one out to me and said, "Look, this might be interesting." And it was a brochure for their house.
Wow.
So we said to them, "Can we go and have a look at it?" And they said, "Yes, there's nobody there. You can go and have a look." And just going down the drive towards the house, it has naturalised Japanese windflowers down the drive, and they were all in bloom. They were just looking magnificent. So I was sold at once.
That's the Callista.
That's Callista.
So you buy the Callista house.
Yes.
You start to do your certificate of horticulture. You start to then find law less appealing.
Yes. Less appealing than horticulture.
Yeah.
Yes. I've left out that we had bought, on one of our trips back to England, we had bought a cottage in a little village called Asho, which had been on the Stoneley estate and had been a worker's cottage on the Stoneley estate. That's sort of between Leamington Spa and Warwick University.
Oh, yeah.
And it's on the River Avon. And a pretty lovely setting, but it didn't have anything much of a garden. It had quite a nice garden, but nothing much. But I won't tell you about the sort of difficult ending of it.
No, you bet. We better keep right. moving on. But
we're back with Burnley.
Back with Burnley, and
yes.
you
Now I thoroughly enjoyed Burnley.
Yeah,
I had good teachers, inspirational teachers, but the subject that puzzled me intellectually was weeds, because of all the uncertainty about it. The fact that, you know, any plant could be a weed. And so I thought it would be worthwhile doing some work on that.
When you say doing some work, you do a PhD.
Eventually I did a PhD on it, yes, yes. I asked them, could I do a PhD? And Greg Moore, who was the principal, said yes, again because of my MA in philosophy. Mm. And Jan Chapper, who I'd known through the National Trust and the Heritage Victoria, was one of my supervisors. So I did that. I took my time. I didn't rush it.
Were you still working at the time?
No.
I
was retired,
yeah,
but I was working. But I was still, I started writing about weeds. I didn't just study them. I started giving papers at weeds conferences. I gave one on sleeper weeds at a weed conference in Cairns that Joni and I went to, in which I poo-hooed the idea of calling things sleeper weeds. Again, because there was no way of telling whether a plant was a sleeper weed or not. But I quite enjoyed writing that paper.
How were these talks and papers received?
Well, some people loved that sleeper weed one, because one of the leading weed people had suggested the title and suggested that it might be useful, and people had started using it. My paper debunked that and said, look, there are no criteria for what's a sleeper weed. There's no way of telling whether a plant is asleep or as a weed or not. So we should apply Occam's razor, and we should just not use the title. One of the chaps in that audience then asked me to give a paper about weeds to the a later weeds conference and ask that it be a keynote paper. And that's the one where I started saying it's time to end the war on weeds, and that was a keynote address to the Weeds Conference.
And again, how did that go down at that conference? What's...
Some liked it, some didn't.
So when that, when people don't like it, how did they? How did you? Well, how did they respond?
Yeah. Oh, there's never much vigorous debate at these Weeds Conferences. Actually, it's a big program, so lots of papers.
So for you, working in law, this it's probably less. Yes, but you would be used to more rigorous debate.
Yes, yeah. I only went to one more. I only gave one more Weeds paper. That was the that was in 2016 in Perth. That's where I gave the paper on Cyprus rotundus. Mm. And that was all, you know, that was pretty sort of routine in a way. But I haven't gone to any Weeds conferences since then, partly because COVID intervened and I lost track of what weed societies are doing.
But that year you mentioned, 2016, I think that's also when you put out your first book, so Weeds, Plants and People came out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you, while you're not talking about it, you're continuing to write and publish, you still are.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And so that enthusiasm for sort of setting the record straight with weeds, or giving them you're taking them from being an evil, if you like, intrinsically, to something more nuanced. Is that would that be fair?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And that's become a mission. Did become a mission for you, or what? Why such a strong passion about that?
Well, I do like taking a garden plant, which some people call weeds, and saying, "Well, look, does it really deserve to be called a weed? It may have weedy tendencies. Is it worth living with those weedy tendencies for the benefits that we get from it?" I mean, Morning Glory is a good example of that, I think. And another one it's in the book.
So I should just say the book we're talking about now is your latest one, which is Weeding Between the Lines, an anthology of essays about our relationship with nature, which has just been published this year, 2023, just a few months ago.
Yeah. Also. Yes. Now there's a paper in that. About the marvel of Peru, the 4 o'clock plant, as it's called in England. And I wrote that because my friend Robin Marks asked me to write a paper for the Garden Journal of the Melbourne Club. He was on the committee. And he wanted me to write something about weeds and my feelings about how... plant may or may not be a weed, and I chose that one because it appeared in the garden here. In the flora, it says that it has appeared in Richmond.
This is the Flora Victoria?
Yes, the Flora Victoria. But it's since obviously moved up here, because if you walk along Miller Street, every other gardener's got it at the front.
You can't trust the distribution. As one of the authors of the Flora Victoria, you can't trust the distribution.
But I rather liked it and when it appeared in the garden. And I pointed it out to my son-in-law. And he said, "Oh, yes, I've got that weed too." So I thought that was a good one to show the possible differences. And I noticed when I've got a man who... every year, or once or twice a year, does a heavy clean out of the garden, and he removed all the 4 o'clock plant that he found. So he obviously thinks it's a weed.
Mm.
It's a very interesting topic to find a plant and then say, well, when does it deserve to be a weed, or is it worth living with?
I think when I read your work, it has parallels with, maybe I'm making too much of it, but parallels with our way we deal with different people in different countries and immigration and things like that. I'm not trying to sort of equate the two, but it's this thing about, you know, a weed itself and its history and its story, separate to kind of where you find it.
Yes, 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 yes. The other, I should get, just going back a little bit, we've left out landscape.
I'm going to, I do want to cover that. And I want to come, so if we look at, just finishing off on weeds, I think, certainly you've written a lot about this, so we probably don't need to go into detail, but do you feel at this point with those two books out and the talks you've given, is that, you know, kind of, do you think there's more, if you're going to give advice to somebody, is there more that you would follow up on, given another lifetime on weeds?
Well, yes, I'm actually struggling with a paper on plane trees at the moment, because that's not a weed.
No, but it's disliked by some people.
It's a bit like a weed in Auckland, though, as you in that paper you sent me points out. It's typical weedy behaviour, growing in cracks in the pavement and growing in walls and things. But I'm finding it quite a. I mean, it's an interesting topic. I start with Eastern Plain, and I start with a quote in Shakespeare, Savage, the man who writes about plants in Shakespeare, who I really like. Goes to the trouble of saying that it had been recorded in Northumberland in 1598 or something, as if that might be the plant Shakespeare had seen. But I think his knowledge about plains was taken from Pliny. People say that he probably read Pliny in the Latin, but if he didn't, the English translation was out in 1601, and Pliny says a lot about plains. And Pliny the Younger talked about plains in one of his letters too. Okay. So I thought that could well be the source for Shakespeare.
Yeah, and do you, I suppose that I'm thinking here too, your early interest in history.
Yes.
Has obviously come back through into this. Do you think that, again, talk about latent interests perhaps,
yes.
Have you found that a way to sort of bring back your history interest as well? Yeah.
Yes, I have. I love working with Pliny. I really do. I'm not so keen on searching for things in Cicero, although we did do Cicero's... one of Cicero's books in school, but we did Pliny's letters at school. That's where I met Pliny.
Okay, and he writes about gardens, doesn't he? I think the older...
His gardens.
Yeah, his own gardens.
His own gardens.
Owns. Yeah, that's right outside Rome.
Yes. So in my paper on Acanthus, I'm able to talk about Pliny having it in his garden. But what other than once I get, I'm struggling with plane trees because I think people would find it hard to tell the difference between the eastern plain that was brought across Europe to and then hybridised to become the London plain. If they saw two growing side by side, eastern plain and London plain, I doubt if they could tell the difference. I've not been able to find any specifications of what the difference would be, and I'm struggling with that a bit.
Okay, I think the leaves do look. Anyway, we won't. Let's not have a taxonomic discussion. But that's interesting too. I think taxonomy. I always find is very close to legal thinking at times too. So I can see an interest in that.
I do like getting the taxonomy of a plant right. Mm. Yes, but planes are difficult because it's not in the floras.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Now, with that, let's go back, if you like, sort of in parallel. So we might have to return historically slightly. But your interest in weeds has certainly been strong in recent years. But if we go back, you talked about joining the National Trust when you were in the UK, and then you've been involved with them in Australia. You've been a member of the Victorian Heritage Council. Yes. So I'm interested in that side of your...
All right, well, I gave a paper which is there on the 40th anniversary of the Garden History Society about the history of the Victorian branch, and that's full of National Trust figures who started it. And I had just joined the National Trust Council a couple of years after the Australian Garden History Society was established. But so I knew what I knew they were doing it, but I didn't get involved at that stage. I'll tell you how I got on to stand for the National Trust Council. Janie found this trust registered house in Richmond, in the Vaucluse in Richmond, which had then been divided into five flats. And she thought that this had possibilities. She was a bit hesitant, and I thought it had possibilities too, so we bought it at auction. We got a Greek builder to remove all the excrescences from the five flats and turn it back to a house, and turn it into a lovely house, actually, a magnificent house. I mean, it had quite a good garden.
What was the address of that house, just for the record?
14 the Vaucluse.
14 Vaucluse, Richmond.
Yes. And we were there for 31 years.
Mm.
Our girls then went to school at St Catherine's. They'd go down Church Street and get the train at East Richmond to go to St Catherine's. Mm. That's when they couldn't prevail upon me to drive them there. But it had a very sloping block on the south side. But I did establish quite a nice garden there. I established a little rose garden there, a sort of quadrant of four roses. And there were, I just forget the other plants in the garden on the wall. It had brick dividing walls on both sides. And we put a pool in eventually. We put a pool in 87. That was to manage my arthritis.
Mm.
I used to swim in the pool every morning. And the front garden was more difficult because it had a very large oak tree near the front boundary, so much so that one gardener that we had doing some work there said, he said, I think I'll describe this as a woodland garden because it was pretty hard to grow things under the oak tree, although I did have a lot of success with that lemon salvia that I had growing just near the letterbox. I put that in at the front. I took a cutting from that from Callista and brought it down and put it in. And we had there was a parking space, a parking apron, and with an urn at the end of it. And I started there the routine of having petunias in summer. Primulas in winter. So I started doing that. It had a climbing rose on the wrought iron at the front, which we tended to. It had sort of lots of nice things in it as a garden. It also had a couple of trees. Oh, the other thing that worked very well, it had clivias, orange clivias, down the side, fitting in period for the house, and they did very well in the shady spots down the side path.
Now, with that description of the garden, which is actually good to get in, I'm glad you brought that up, that then you got you connected with the Heritage Council, is that right?
That got, with the National Trust.
Because of the house.
Because not long after we were there, there was a developer who bought a Victorian house further down the Vaucluse, who was applying to demolish it and put up a block of flats. So we all opposed that. And one night there was a knock on the door, and it was Warwick Ford from the National Trust saying that the National Trust was interested in opposing that too. But it then seemed to me that the National Trust could perhaps do with a bit of help when I saw what happened with that project. We worked it out all right because...
Do you mean legal help or other help?
Conservation help.
Conservation help, okay.
because that problem got solved. We blocked the development at VCAT the first time. Then the developer put in an amended development. But I knew a friend who was looking to buy a house in Richmond, a solicitor, and I said to him, look, that developer might be getting a bit sick of all this. Why don't you approach him and make him an offer to buy the house? And he did that. So that saved. That Victorian house is still there. He did a bit of work to improve it, but it's still there. Anyway, so that's when I decided to join Trust Council. So I stood for Trust Council in 1982, and I was on Trust Council until 1997. And I had some stages I was president, some stages I was vice president, there was a campaign against me in 1997 when I was due for re-election, because at a public meeting about the museum being built next to the exhibition building, I had said that I thought it would be good for the exhibition building to have the museum there. And people who were opposed to the museum then mounted a campaign to get me off Trust Council. I succeeded.
I find this interesting because this to me is a pattern where you're willing to make your own independent decision about something. And I'm thinking of weeds as well.
Yeah.
Rather than perhaps go with what is...
What's the accepted?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, some people on the trust, Nick Safstrom was one, said he didn't know, after I'd done that, he didn't know whether he should resign his membership of the trust or not. He was so much opposed to the idea. But I could see that the museum would be the salvation of the exhibition building. Instead of just standing there in the garden and being used for exams and things like that,
right.
it could have a life with the museum.
Well, I don't want to bring this to a contemporary issue, which is in today's papers. Well, yes. Very, very briefly, but yes, I mean, the interesting thing about having a garden show there means people go inside the building and love the scene of building being used.
Yes.
And I'm not making any call here today on that issue.
And the garden display inside is always magnificent.
So it is interesting about old buildings being so precious you can't do anything in them.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway, so then they nominated me to the Heritage Council to make up for that. So I was on the Heritage Council for a couple of years, and in particular I was on the Heritage Council's Landscape Advisory Committee. And there I had a lot to do with Jan Schapper, who was on Trust Council and who was on the Heritage Council and who was on the Landscape Advisory Committee. And she and I did a couple of projects together. We started having conferences, landscape conferences around Victoria, where people would give papers about the landscape and the issues.
Mm.
And then we brought out a collection of the best of the papers. She and I edited it, and that's published. That's here. I forget, but just, yeah, it's, no, it's other, that's right.
This one. Oh, yes.
That's studies. That's the studies that we jointly edited studies.
Oh, sorry, I better get you, I'll have to get you to go back.
Sorry.
That's all right. In here.
Not here. Anyway,
that's right. I will have a look. So, why don't we
jointly edited a book about landscapes and heritage landscapes.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, of course.
Which got published by the Heritage Council, and Jan and I also edited the last number of Heritage Studies that the Society used to publish.
Okay.
I had previously published a paper in it. And I was sorry to see it go, but it went.
Things do change. I'm aware we're getting a lengthy interview, which is good, but I want to perhaps take us to the Australian garden history side of it. You want to mention something first before we do that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not certain what year I joined that, but it was while I was doing my course at Burnley.
Yeah.
And I got onto the committee, the Victorian committee, because when Burnley was being put on the Victorian Heritage Register, they wanted to put it on with only half of the main drive. They wanted to put the left-hand side on the register, and the right-hand side be free for commercial development. So there were the Garden History Society was very upset about that, and you had these respectable ladies waving placards at the tram stop near the Burnley Gardens saying Brax Buggers Burnley.
Which side did you take on this issue, Tom?
I thought it's crazy to put half a driveway on the Heritage Register.
Yep.
And I appeared at they had a hearing of the Heritage Committee, and I appeared at that.
Okay.
Oh, there were two hearings, actually. There was a meeting in the Richmond Town Hall, a full meeting about it, and I spoke at that. There was a meeting of the Heritage Council, and I appeared at that, and I spoke at that. And after that, Pamela Jelly, I think, invited me to join the Victorian Committee of the Garden History Society, and I then sort of slowly moved up, as it were, until I became chair. The 6-year rule. I was just an ordinary elected member for 1 year. Then I was vice to Colleen Morris for 1 or 2 years. And then I was chair for 3 years, I think.
So Colleen's in Sydney. You were chair of the Victorian branch?
This is the National Manager
Committee. The National Manager Committee, that's right.
Yeah. While I was chair, we had the conference in Launceston.
Yep.
We had a conference in Geelong, and we had a conference in Ballarat. The one that I was most involved with was a conference in Ballarat. I've got a note somewhere of the year, but it mightn't matter. It's in the records. You can find it easily.
Can I ask what observations you would make about your time in that role and the society? Any kind of general...
One of the things I liked about it was that, unlike the Heritage Council, where there are a lot of politics going on, and unlike the National Trust, where there's a bit of politics going on, the Garden History Society didn't behave like that. I came to understand that gardeners are basically nice people, and coups and that sort of thing are the last thing that would happen on the Garden History Society.
And has it changed during your time there, or have you seen it change over that since then? Is there any kind of general things you'd note?
No, it started to change its interests.
Mm.
The Hobart Conference certainly started to introduce Aboriginal landscapes, which hadn't, I think, before then been considered by the society.
Mm.
So that was an interesting trend, I thought, and also your trend about coping with climate warming. Yeah. That's why they want to cut down all the plane trees.
Oh, because they're not going to survive.
Yeah, they say. Why they say it, I don't know. They come from Greece and Turkey and places.
Yeah, I mean, I find them a little bit dull as a tree, but I think they're a very tough tree. I would be very surprised if they didn't tolerate change.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. And I've not closely followed sort of what the National Management Committee's been doing, because I've been busy writing for the journal. And particularly since Francesca became editor, she started out not wanting to publish a paper of mine in every number of the journal. She said she had to share the love. But then she found it very useful to have this storehouse of papers that I'd written so that she was never at a loss. So that meant that for some years, each issue of the journal would have a paper by me in it.
And you enjoy that writing?
I enjoy that very much, yeah.
We haven't actually mentioned in this discussion, we talked about writing before we started, but just you've written, you would have, studied at a university, and you've written two books and written many articles and given talks. Is that something that's always been an interest to you, writing?
Yes, it has. But since Joan died, it's been my salvation, I would say.
And we should just note for the record, Joan died...
2019. September the 11th. 2019 of cancer. She'd had cancer from 2014 on. So she was, those 5 years, she was having treatment for cancer, but then it beat her in the end.
And she was also a very passionate lover of plants and gardens, and particularly roses.
Yes, yes. And we, 2018 is the last conference that we went to.
Okay. Yeah. And so the writing, yes, you found that enjoyed the writing.
She used to always check my writing with a critical eye and improve it, say things like, what's the point of this, or, you know, why have you included that sort of thing, as well as checking it for spelling.
Do you have any flaws that you keep making that she found?
Yes. We can all make mistakes.
Oh, of course. No, it's always interesting sometimes, whether...
Yes. But she liked it that I was writing the articles, I think.
Yeah, oh, good.
And I really do think they've kept me sane since she died.
Well, they've been... And I think they've been wonderful for the journal, because you are tackling... I think... If you look at what the society is about, which is gardens and history, and that sort of whole thing, your articles have a bit of history, and then they have the nomenclature or the taxonomy, which a lot of people in society like. They actually like to know what plants are. And then it has that philosophical bent of whether it's a weed or whether it's what its origins are.
Yes.
And that's good. I think that it's a knowledge society, I think. Did you find that people enjoy learning in that society?
Oh, yes. The practical gardeners, I think, still like reading about these things. You know,
Now, we're coming towards the end, so I just want to check if there's anything. I've covered most of the points that I'd written down for myself. I talked about the places you stayed in, and around weeds, around landscape. Do you think there's anything we've left out of that story, or any topic you want to make sure we mention here?
No, I don't think so. It's a bit. It's not quite in point. They asked me to give a talk about the history of the Victorian branch for the 40th anniversary, and I really liked doing that. But so many of the people, what I was able to bring out, was the close connection between the beginnings of the Garden History Society and the National Trust.
Okay.
And so that transition has been very good for me. I mean, I'm still a member of the National Trust. I'm a life member and an honorary member. But I loved just sitting out all the people like Margaret Darling, Peter Timms, all the people who were involved in setting the Garden History Society up. And I can remember Margaret Darling when they were organising a conference in Melbourne, rushing round, sort of getting things in shape and things, because she was then, I think, vice president of the, vice president of the National Trust. So I used to see her on Trust Council. I think.
So that's interesting. So at that point, there was obviously an interest in setting up this new society.
Yeah.
Was it felt, was it, perhaps just tell me around how that, you know, was it around... there was a need for this that didn't exist, or that the National Trust wasn't doing enough in gardens? Is there a bit of subtlety in how was that? What was driving that?
I think Peter Timms's book had a lot to do with it. I think the feeling was that buildings were getting more attention than gardens, and that gardens needed the attention.
Peter Watts, or no, Peter Timms.
Peter Timms.
Peter Watts.
Oh, well, did you pass me that thing just on the front? No, that one.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Peter
Watts.
Yeah.
Peter Watts.
No, that's fine. I know. That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sorry, where were you?
So I think his book was very influential in terms of highlighting the importance of gardens.
Yeah.
And that corresponded with what Joni and I had found, because we'd found, looking at historic buildings in England, that we became less interested in the house and more interested in the gardens. And we even did, back in the 90s, we'd done garden tours in England. I wrote one up in Trust News in 1997. I wrote up there's an article I wrote on the gardens of South Somerset, where we had a lovely garden tour, going to all these, I think, six or so gardens in South Somerset. We stayed at a nice bed and breakfast, and so we'd moved out of houses, and we were less interested in buildings.
Do you think that same feeling had moved as a community sense in Australia, like as a more general...
I think there was a growing recognition that not enough attention was being paid to gardens,
Yeah. Do you think that is now solved or resolved, if you like?
Probably, yes, I think so, yes. And certainly the properties of the National Trust has got in Victoria that have got a good garden, like Como and Ripon Lee. The gardens there are very much appreciated and valued, and not just seen as a sort of maintenance problem.
I think that's the perfect place to stop, if you would be happy with that, not just seen as a maintenance problem.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I'll just finish up the interview with John Dwyer, so Tim Entwistle here, and very much appreciate your time. Just pull that too.